home for every Notre Dame football game.
Goodbye, Brandon Wimbush. 58 yards.
Sanders is pulling away with every stride, and he goes in. 92 yards.
Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT, presents.
Race is on. Josh Adams wins it. Touchdown, Notre Dame. 98 yards. 76-yard touchdown play to Equanimeous St. Brown.
Budweiser's weekday sports beat.
Faulkner breaks one tackle down the near sideline, gets a block, cuts back inside. Touchdown, Faulkner and Mishawaka.
York now in front, Ogilvy. They score! They score! Notre Dame to the Frozen Four! Gets up and in by Rex Kluger with 1.5 seconds left. Notre Dame leads.
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is 7 minutes after the top of the hour. Budweiser's weekday sports beat, presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. It's a bye week for the Notre Dame football team. We'll have a little practice session tomorrow. We expect Brandon Wimbush to be cleared and take the first team reps for the Fighting Irish tomorrow in practice. Brandon did not play last Saturday at North Carolina due to a foot injury. No problem. Ian Book got the start and helped the Irish beat Carolina 33-10. The Fighting Irish are now a 5-1 football team. Their next game, October 21st at home against the University of Southern California. And since USC, a ranked team, is the next team on the ledger for the Fighting Irish, we're going to talk about the final six teams on the Irish schedule in our opening segment. Five of the six teams are ranked in the latest AP poll. What should we expect from those opponents? Eric and I will break it down coming up in just a couple of moments. At the bottom of this hour, some of the sounds of the college football weekend. Oklahoma stunned at home by Iowa State. TCU continues to play good football very quietly in the Big 12. Michigan stumbled at home to Michigan State. And Alabama rolls to another victory. You will hear from those head coaches coming up in a little bit. My five question of the day. Eric is an Associated Press college football top 25 voter. And he will tell us who he put in his top five this week. I can tell you he had the Fighting Irish at number 16. Sean will join me next hour for the program. We'll talk about how the Irish got to 5-1. Also, Mitchell Trubisky. Bears fans, what did you take away from last night's performance? His first start in the National Football League. The young quarterback played well at times, but my goodness, some of the players around him on offense are just miserable in their execution right now. The penalties. The tight end, Sims, did he catch a pass yet in that game? I mean, not a whole lot of help. He had his struggles at times, and I guess you could say for the second time in a few days that Notre Dame beat North Carolina. That happened actually down in Chapel Hill Saturday, but Harrison Smith, the former Notre Dame defensive back, picked off the former Carolina quarterback Trubisky late in the fourth quarter, deep in Bears territory, leading to the game-winning field goal. And the Vikings went on to beat the Bears 20-17. You'll hear from Mitchell Trubisky, and we'll talk about Mitchell Trubisky coming up next hour. Rapid fire and a Major League Baseball update. The Chicago Cubs are scheduled to play Game 4 of their National League Divisional Series against Washington. First pitch is scheduled for 4:38 Central Time. There is rain in the area, so it might be a night where there are some stoppages along the way, but they hope to get the game in. Here is the Cubs lineup for Game 4. John Jay will lead off and play center field. Chris Bryant hits second, bats third. He is 5-for-11 all-time against Nationals starting pitcher Tanner Roark. Anthony Rizzo, the hero from last night with that bloop RBI single in the eighth inning, he's in the three-hole batting behind Bryant and playing first base. Hitting cleanup is Wilson Contreras, the Cub catcher. Ben Zobrist back in the lineup again. He's batting fifth and playing right field. They are not going to start Jason Hayward today. Hayward, lifetime against Roark, 0-for-18. So they'll give up the defense for Zobrist's bat in the lineup. Kyle Schwarber hitting sixth and playing left field. Addison Russell playing shortstop, batting seventh. Javier Baez back in the lineup today. He's hitting eighth and playing second base. And Jake Arrieta will be the starting pitcher for the Chicago Cubs, a 6 ERA in 3 starts in September, but a sub-2 ERA when you look back at July and August. Dealt with a hamstring injury, of course, late in the year. Rourke versus Arrieta, the Game 4 matchup. If the Cubs win, they'll take on the Dodgers in the National League Championship Series. If the Nationals win, we go back to D.C. for a Game 5 between the Cubs and the Nationals. So that's what's happening with Major League Baseball today. The Indians and the Yankees will play their deciding Game 5 tomorrow night, Progressive Field in Cleveland, Ohio. Yankees are scaring the Indians right now. If the Indians do not win this game, that long winning streak is kind of forgotten, unfortunately. It's all about what you do in the postseason and professional sports. So that long winning streak, yeah, that was pretty cool. But to get knocked out in the first round would be a huge disappointment for the Tribe in Cleveland. And then all the focus will be on the winless Cleveland Browns and when they might win another football game. Eric, we are going to talk about the final six opponents for the Fighting Irish: USC, North Carolina State, Wake Forest, Miami, Navy, and Stanford. 5 of the 6 teams left on the schedule, ranked in the latest Associated Press poll. USC 13, NC State 20, Miami 11, Navy 25, Stanford 23, and Wake Forest is the only team not ranked. That was actually the coaches' poll I used there for those particular numbers. But let's start with the opponent coming up on October 21st at Notre Dame Stadium, the USC Trojans. They are 5-1, 3-1 in the Pacific 12 Conference. They've outscored their opponents 213-139. A couple of numbers that stand out. They are tied for 35th in the country at 35.5 points per game. I'm not using pass efficiency for this next stat, just passing yards with Sam Darnold, 286 yards per game. That is 32nd in the country. Games that stand out on their schedule so far: they beat Stanford at the Coliseum 42-24. They beat Texas at the Coliseum 27-24. That game was not as easy as expected. And their lone loss was at Washington State 30-27. So USC, Eric, a top five team at the start of the year. Now they're a football team that I think is still trying to find themselves. They have not played like a top five team, even though they're 5-1. They have been hit hard by injuries. They've lost at least one offensive lineman that would start for the season due to injury. So I feel like, thinking back to the summer and what I thought of USC then and what I thought of Notre Dame, I had this down as a loss for Notre Dame. As I look at these two teams, as they have presented themselves for a month and a half, all of a sudden I feel like Notre Dame is the favorite in this football game. Although USC, Eric, has some capabilities that could take advantage of some deficiencies that I think some teams have not taken advantage of so far this year. And I mainly mean with their offense against some of the parts of the defense for the Notre Dame that has not been fully challenged so far this year. And I think you know where I'm going with that, the safety position.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, people that are watching Notre Dame say, hey, I haven't seen their safeties make horrible mistakes, and they seem to be playing pretty well.
But they're in the right spot.
Right, but some of what makes you a great defense rather than a good defense is the capabilities of the safety. Mike Elko isn't going to ask those safeties to do more than they can. So let's say you plugged Harrison Smith as a college player into the safety. They could do a lot more with their defense with somebody like that. You know, Mike Elko's going to say, okay, here's what my safeties can do. I'm not going to extend them. Now, USC is a team that will try to extend them with their game plan. With formation and game plan, they will try to isolate Jalen Elliott and Nick Coleman in as many one-on-one matchups as they can possibly get, which means, you know, Mike Elko will have to have a counter move to that. And so that's where USC, I think, is kind of dangerous. They're kind of typical USC in that they are a little bit self-destructive. They are one of the most penalized teams in the country, for example. They're also turning the ball over at one of the highest rates in the country. The thing that they do, or one of the things they do well, is they also force turnovers. So they're going to be able to force some. But when you look at their numbers compared to Notre Dame's, their offense is more balanced. But guess what? Notre Dame has a better scoring offense and a better total offense right now. So I think it's a winnable game. But USC will challenge Notre Dame, as will all six of the remaining in different ways. They will challenge Notre Dame in ways they haven't been tested, except for one way. Georgia, I still think, is the best defense Notre Dame will face all season.
Well, USC has Sam Darnold at the start of the year. Heisman candidate, Heisman favorite in some people's eyes, number one pick in the 2018 NFL draft. It's been a little bit of an up and down year for Darnold so far. He's completing 64% of his passes for 1,705 yards, 12 touchdown passes, but he has been picked off 9 times so far this year. And when you take a look at the pass efficiency offenses that the Irish have faced so far this year, USC would be the second most difficult pass efficiency offense behind Georgia, who is 34th. And Eric actually gave me access to his secret statistical document. This is like getting to use the red phone in the Oval Office. So I feel very, very honored because you put in a ton of work doing this every week. But take a look at the next few opponents for Notre Dame in terms of pass efficiency offense. And I know you believe in this number.
I do. Not this is for people. It isn't actual passing yards. It's how well you pass.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the national champions, and almost every one of them is at least in the 30s, and most of them are in the top 15.
And in 2012, Notre Dame offense pass efficiency was 74th.
Yep.
Kind of an anomaly.
Yes.
In your world.
They were actually the lowest team in that statistic to get to the championship game of any team in the BCS or playoff era.
So here's what's coming up for Notre Dame. This is just pass efficiency offense. USC 45. NC State 28. Ryan Finley has not thrown an interception so far this year. Wake Forest 31.
John Wolford's played well. Kendall Hinton had a step in last week, didn't play as well. Throwing the ball, ran the ball really well for Wake. They're much better offensively than they were.
Miami is 37, and Navy doesn't throw it a whole lot, but when they do, they're effective. This is probably the one you kind of say, okay, but they're 9 right now in pass efficiency offense. Stanford is the weakest opponent left in pass efficiency offense at 76.
Right, and so you look at that, and they're also trying to figure out, is it Keller Christ, is it KJ Costello? Really, I think KJ Costello has played better, but it looks like they're gone back to Keller Christ for now, a senior captain.
Couple other notes on USC. A big discrepancy between their leading pass catcher and number two. Darnold has really used Deontay Burnett a lot this year. 41 catches, 527 yards, 6 touchdowns. The next closest is Tyler Vaughns with 19 and Stephen Mitchell with 18. And you can't forget about Ronald Jones II, their running back, averaging 6.2 yards per carry, 7 touchdowns. Going back to last year, Eric, he has scored a touchdown in 12 consecutive games, and he is a difference maker. But here's the stat I want to bring up. When you think about the way Notre Dame has run the football successfully this year with that power running attack, entering this week, USC is 55th in the country in run defense at 143 yards per game, and they are giving up 4.13 yards per carry. There is an area where you hope Notre Dame can take advantage of that USC front.
Well, Western Michigan ran all over them in a game that was tight into the fourth quarter and ended up being a 49-31 USC win. Then they played Stanford, who lost to USC, but Bryce Love had a big day. You know, Washington State ran the ball against USC, and that was an eye-opener. It's going to be interesting this week with Utah. USC has Utah at home. Utah traditionally runs the ball pretty well. I'll tell you what else really hurts USC, Darren, is they don't have a bye week this year. They go straight from September 2nd to November 18th. So with these injuries, it's not like they can say, well, you know what, we play Notre Dame in 2 weeks. Let's sit people against Utah this week. You can't, because if Utah wins this game, Utah has the inside track to winning the Pac-12 South.
Let's move along to North Carolina State. the opponent after USC. The Wolfpack are 5-1, 3-0 in the ACC. They've outscored their opponents 213 to 142 so far this year. They have the same exact points per game total as USC, 35.5, and Ryan Finley averaging 305 passing yards per game, number 21 in the country. Finley is completing 70% of his passes, 10 touchdowns, and no interceptions, and he and Jalen Samuels are on the same page. 50 receptions already for Samuels for 425 yards, but it's interesting, only 8.5 yards per catch for Samuels. And when you look at their schedule to date, you kind of thought NC State might be down this year after they lost at home to South Carolina in the opener, 35-28, but they have ripped off five in a row, including a win in Tallahassee over Florida State, 27-21, and their most recent game, a home victory over Louisville, 39-25. So this is probably, in my estimation, the team on the Notre Dame schedule that has changed the most, in my opinion, from the summer to six games into the season.
Yeah, they've. We thought that they certainly would have an outstanding defensive line, and kind of thought the quarterback would be really good. It was how all the other pieces were going to come together. And I knew Jalen Samuels was still on the team, and he's a kind of a fullback tight end that gets thrown to a lot. And he's not your typical size for any of that stuff. He's just a really neat football player that doesn't fit into a box. But they are vulnerable in an area where Notre Dame has not been good. And that's why I keep saying balance, balance, balance with the offense. They're eighth in the country in run defense. They're 85th in pass efficiency defense. And if you're gonna get them, you better be able to do both, because they will put you in third and long situations. Then they're vulnerable, and you have to convert those. But they are the best run defense Notre Dame has left on the schedule, and not even close.
Interesting stat: they're 102nd in the country in third down defense.
Exactly, because of that passing. Pass defense, people are picking them apart, and that's why you see their scores, you know, Syracuse getting into the 20s, Florida State getting to 21. You see them giving up some points and yards. It's because their pass defense. So Brandon Wimbush is going to have to be on his game in that NC State game, because there will be opportunities in the passing game for him in that game.
Haim Hines is their top running back, 100 carries, 513 yards, 5.1 yards per carry, 5 touchdowns. It's worth mentioning already, but if it's a close game, special teams, always a factor. And NC State, their kicking game, it's a little uneasy right now. Carson Wise is their place kicker. He has 6 of 10 in field goal tries, but 40 yards or less this year, he is only 5 of 9. So NC State, not totally confident in their kicking game right now, could play a major factor in the outcome of the Irish game. And you take a look at NC State, I know Eric has mentioned this, but run defense, 8th in the country, 90.7 yards per game, and giving up just 3.06 yards per carry, hence the balance conversation that you've been talking about.
Right. They get after the quarterback really well. You remember Nick Chubb from Georgia, the running back. Well, his cousin Bradley Chubb was one of the best defensive ends in the country. Weird scheduling tick with them. They have a bye right before Notre Dame, so you say, oh wow, that's a huge advantage to have a bye. But they have a game against Clemson right after Notre Dame. So you wonder, okay, are they going to be fully focused for Notre Dame, knowing that Clemson game could put them in the ACC championship if they win it. Basically, because then they have Boston College, Wake, and Carolina the rest of their schedule after Clemson.
The Irish have made a living off turning over the opposition, and they have scored points off turnovers. 73-10 is the advantage for Notre Dame. USC, amongst all the teams on the Irish schedule, they have the biggest problem turning the football over. They're 117th in turnovers lost. It's interesting, the next 5 opponents are all in the top 28. In taking care of the football, including NC State, Wake Forest, Miami, all 3rd in the country, Stanford 12th, and Navy is 28th. So it might be more difficult to turn over those teams and get those points on the board coming off turnovers. Since we're getting a little late into the show here, why don't we do Wake Forest? We'll save the other three for tomorrow.
Okay, that makes, sounds good.
That makes more sense. So let's now go to Wake Forest. They will be a team that looked good early on in the season, maybe leveling off a tad bit right now. The Demon Deacons are 4-2, 1-2 in the ACC. They've outscored their opponents 184-100. Games of note on their schedule so far: a win in Chestnut Hill over Boston College, 34-10. Hard-fought game at home against Florida State. Seminoles won 26-19. Wake Forest led in the fourth quarter. And Wake Forest in Death Valley last Saturday lost to the defending national champion Clemson Tigers 28-14. Kendall Hinton got the opportunity to play for Wake Forest against Clemson. And so far this year, 25 of 43 for 382 yards. He's ran for 118 yards. And it sure seems like Wake Forest, their offense is better, but the running game is not where it needs to be. Arkeem Bird is their top ball carrier. 49 carries, 267 yards, 5.4 yards per carry. But here comes the but. You want the but?
I want the but.
Here's the but. Against Boston College, Florida State, and Clemson, Bird has a total of 14 carries for 38 yards. Against Utah State, 19 carries, 120. So even their rushing numbers as they lay right now might be a little deceiving, because they did most of their damage against one team, Utah State, and they didn't do anything against BC, Florida State, and Clemson.
They have a bye this week, and then they play at Georgia Tech and then Louisville at home before they play Notre Dame. We mentioned their quarterbacks. John Wolford has kind of reasserted himself as a starter, but he was injured last week. And they had the same deal. If Kendall Hinton had gotten hurt, they were going to put Wolford in for him. So they had the same kind of depth chart as Notre Dame.
And he's their leading ball carrier, rushing guard so far this year, Wolford.
And I think Hinton did pretty well against Clemson as well. And they made some adjustments against Clemson. Now, Clemson lost Kelly Bryant, their star quarterback, early in that game. But I think this is a much improved Wake team. We'll learn a lot more about them the next couple of games before they play Notre Dame, with Georgia Tech and Louisville coming up. They're playing a lot better since their radio announcer isn't giving away game plans and playbooks anymore. The one thing is, though, they are running the same exact scheme as when Mike Elko was there. So that should give them some familiarity. Jay Sovel, who was Minnesota's defensive coordinator last year, they hired him because he uses the Rover concept. He uses a lot of the same concept as Mike Elko. So there will be some familiarity with that.
Wake Forest run defense, 54th in the country, giving up 142 yards per game, 3.51 yards per carry so far this year for the Demon Deacons, who are 4-2. Tomorrow, we'll take care of three more ranked teams at the end of the Irish schedule: Miami of Florida, Navy, and Stanford. What should we expect from those teams? Eric and I will break it down in the opening segment of tomorrow's Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. It is 29 minutes after the top of the hour. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. Coming up next, we'll take a tour around college football, some of the sounds of a very interesting weekend across college football. That comes your way next on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on 96.1 FM WSBT.
This is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Going in is Josh Adams, and the lid is on this game for Notre Dame as they go up 41-16.
On Michiana's sports leader,
Wimbush on target inside the 40 and the 30 and dancing down to the 28-yard line was Cameron Smith.
96.1 FM, WSBT.
Here's a ball on the field. Notre Dame comes attacking. Did they get it? And Dalen Hayes scooped it up.
Along with the Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune, Eric Hansen, I'm WSBT Sports Director Darren Pritchett. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday evening. No Brian Kelly press conference today because it's a bye week. We will not hear from Coach Kelly until a week from today at noon, because it's USC week and he just wants to talk.
There you go.
What were you laughing at me? I didn't know what. I thought I had maybe something goofy on my face.
No, you still look fetching.
Oh, thank you. I greatly appreciate that. All right, so Let's get to some of the sounds of a very interesting college football weekend. We begin in Norman, Oklahoma, where Oklahoma was a 31-point favorite taking on an Iowa State team using their third-string quarterback, and the Cyclones stunned number 3 Oklahoma, sending the Sooners tumbling down the national rankings. And this is the first speed bump for Sooners head coach Lincoln Riley.
I'm very disappointed. I mean, there's no doubt. I'm not dejected. You know, I'm still. I know what this team can be. You know, we in that locker room know what this team can be. The fact that we're not playing like it right now is disappointing. Absolutely, it is. But I feel like that we've got the makeup in there. I told them in there, this will be the most important game of the year for us right now as far as how we respond to it. And we'll look back at the end of the year, and regardless of what we do, I think we'll be able to point back to this moment right here and say, that's the moment where we turned it around.
Well, you don't want that type of moment to happen after a bad loss to Iowa State on your home field. So, Eric, it sure seemed like, as we look way down the road at the college football playoff and which four teams that are ultimately going to get in, we were trending, in my opinion, for the Pacific 12 Conference to be in a tough spot with the way things were lining up now. And again, so much can happen. I totally understand that. But with Oklahoma losing, you still have TCU undefeated. Oklahoma State lost on their home field to TCU. Washington State is still undefeated out of the Pacific 12 Conference. So does the Oklahoma loss enhance the opportunity for the Pacific 12 Conference to have a team that might make the college football playoff?
I would think so. And, you know, the committee might look at things differently than the AP voters and certainly how the coaches vote and the people that stand in for the coaches that vote. But it definitely hurt because now there's a couple things that come into play. Now you're kind of counting on TCU to carry your banner. And if they lose, which it's entirely possible that they could lose a game or two, then you have committed now to this new Big 12 championship game, which you say, wow, well, the 13th data point, all the researchers tell us that we needed that. But what if the second place team wins that championship game?
Adios.
Yeah. And even if the first place team does, what if they just play them the week before? So are you really getting a fresh data point? You know, usually why you have these championship games is because those teams have not played each other. Every once in a while there could be a rematch, but usually those teams haven't faced each other in the regular season. With the SEC East and the SEC West, usually if you're going to win the East, you haven't played one of the tough Western teams or the one that's going to win it. Same with Big Ten West, Big Ten East, Coastal and Atlantic with the ACC. It's very unusual, and so you're playing a game that's kind of a first-time matchup. So this Big 12 thing is really confusing. The one saving grace they have is that Oklahoma beat Ohio State, and if Ohio State ends up being the Big 10 champ, that helps Oklahoma. If they're not the best team in the Big 10, then that doesn't help Oklahoma or the Big 12 nearly as much.
Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett, Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, taking you around what was a very interesting college football weekend. Staying in the Big 12 for a moment, TCU held on to pick up a victory over West Virginia in a top 25 matchup. And Horned Frogs head coach Gary Patterson has his team sitting at 5-0.
We found a way to get to 5-0. It's hard to be 5-0. Right. First, you know, we tie with some people in the conference, and then you could move on to the next game. Now we got to go to Manhattan, Kansas, which is 11 o'clock in the morning and a tough place to play.
Those early starts sometimes are tricky. So Horned Frogs will go on the road to take on the Wildcats this Saturday. Eric, you buying or selling TCU as a legitimate playoff contender?
I'm buying them if they continue to improve. When you look at who they beat Jackson State. Okay, they've won at Arkansas, but everybody's kind of beaten Arkansas this year. High-scoring game with SMU. Impressive win at Oklahoma State. And then a touchdown over West Virginia. You look at what's coming up. Now you got to include Iowa State as the tough ones. But They have a four-game stretch of Iowa State, Texas, Oklahoma, and Texas Tech. That's going to be difficult to get out of that unscathed, and three out of those four are on the road. When you look at them statistically, you try to predict, and you look at the key metrics. They're really good passing efficiency. They're really good in rushing defense. They're not very good at pass defense. Mm-hmm. Total defense numbers are kind of alarming. So they're a team that, and they're not turning the ball over too much, they're a team that's going to have to get better defensively if I'm going to buy into them. But I'm okay with them now.
That's every team in the Big 12.
Yeah, that's every team in the Big 12. But, I mean, that makes a difference. And if there's a guy that's going to be good on defense, it's Gary Patterson. I mean, he was a very good defensive coach. But that stretch, Iowa State, Texas, Oklahoma, Texas Tech, with three out of those four on the road, I think that's going to be difficult to get through without a loss. Mm-hmm.
Next up, we go to the Big Ten Conference, where weather was a factor at the Big House in Ann Arbor. Michigan State goes into Michigan and hands the Wolverines a 14-10 defeat. Wolverines head coach Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah, there was good things, not enough good things, and we stopped ourselves when we, you know, in the course of piecing drives together, we turned the ball over. That's the way I saw it.
And here is Harbaugh talking about trying to get the offense going.
We were trying to run the ball. We're getting the first down. We were trying to piece drives together. We really were. That was we needed to score points, and we needed to put some drives together, and that's what we were trying to do.
With O'Korn at quarterback and with the schedule coming up, there is some possibilities that Michigan could take a couple of hits here a long way in the second half of their season. I never really felt like they were a top 10 team early on in the year, kind of like USC. You take a look at them on paper, you think, yeah, they could be good, but when you watch them play, both of those teams just never truly wowed me, and they really still haven't to this particular moment. But credit to Michigan State. After they were beaten soundly by the Irish on their home field, they beat a respectable Iowa team at Spartan Stadium, and Iowa could not run the football. Now, weather was a huge factor in the Michigan game. I mean, it was almost impossible to throw the football with the wind and the rain. So,
gee, where have we seen that?
Yeah, no kidding. So you could stack the line of scrimmage and slow down the Michigan running attack, but should there be a little panic in Ann Arbor right now?
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is because I think their defense is really good, and they had a lot. They had the fewest starters of anybody in the country coming back, five on both sides of the ball total. So if Michigan has a hiccup, but
yeah, there was
Jim Harbaugh is going to get beat up in the media, and we've seen the comparisons to Brady Hoke's record and the records versus the rivals Ohio State and Michigan State, but.
You are who you are, 1-4.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, their offense looks inept. I mean, their defense is going to have to win games for them. But I still think, I think Don Brown is amazing, and he is the defensive coordinator at Michigan who used to be at Boston College and would turn these things, you know, keep reloading with his defenses year after year after year. But you look at their schedule, they got at Indiana this week, then it's at Penn State.
Yeah.
Then it gets a little softer. Rutgers, Minnesota. Maryland will be interesting on
Minnesota,
the road.
Minnesota, eh.
I'm not.
Maybe.
But then at Maryland, at Wisconsin, then Ohio State. So we'll see.
There's three possible losses there. Penn State, Wisconsin, Ohio State.
Right. But again, there was a lot of roster turnover on this team, and I think it's certainly caught up with them on offense.
Well, he's had sleepovers and stuff, so he should have all the talent by now.
Well, maybe he doesn't know who's on his roster.
Yeah. That could be what it is. All right, and finally, from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Crimson Tide rolled to another victory, but it just never seems to be joyous down in Tuscaloosa. For whatever reason, it's never good enough, and by golly, Alabama's play is always affected by the media. It's always the media's fault. And here is Nick Saban from after they won last Saturday. He says what is written about his team interferes with his coaching.
I'm trying to get our players to listen to me instead of listening to you guys. You know, all that stuff you write about how good we are and all that stuff they hear on ESPN, it's like poison. You know what I mean? It's like taking poison, like rat poison. All right, so I'm asking them, are you going to listen to me or are you going to listen to these guys about how good you are? All right, just like your question right now, if we get stopped 3 out of 4 times, like that's a bad thing? We're not going to beat everybody 66-3.
Well, what's really fun is if you Google rat poison, Lane Kiffin comes up trolling Nick Saban.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
Yeah, he said they posted the odds for teams to win their conference USA, and Florida Atlantic, which is where he is now, came up with the highest percentage. So he tweeted, please stop media, ! This is rat poison to our players. Pretty funny.
Nick, excuse me, Coach Saban, you've won 24-7, 41-10, 41-23, 59-0, 66-3, and 27-19 on the road against Texas A&M. Those of us in the media, hey, we're dummies, but we can piece together what we see and look at the data. Alabama's really, really good, so we apologize for saying your team is really, really good. So I guess they should all just say, Alabama stinks. They're terrible. Look at this. They're only winning 27-19. Just go that road just to see what Nick would say.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think all this stuff is amusing. I don't take it too seriously. I know that some people were taken aback by Nick Saban and saying, why is he attacking the media? That's just who Nick Saban is, and I don't think he really means it, and I think it's all kind of what makes college football so colorful.
You heard some of the reporters laughing when he said rat poison. If he was ticked off, he would have said, what are you laughing about?
He
would have gotten on them, so he was just playing the part. It is 12 minutes in front of the top of the hour on WSBT. Who are the top 5 teams in the country? Eric will reveal his AP top 5 for this week next on WSBT.
One question, 5 answers. This is the My 5 Question of the Day on Michiana's Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Eric Hansen is an AP voter for the college football poll. He has the Irish at number 16 this week. But who is in his top 5? Let's reveal that right now with our My 5 Question of the Day. We begin with team number 5.
Well, I really wrestled between my 5 and my number 6 team. But I ended up Washington edged Washington State for the number 5 spot. Washington still hasn't played anybody yet. They look impressive, and they've got a great return, man. My goodness, but we'll see. You know, they'll get challenged eventually, but right now they're number 5.
Number 4 in the country.
Penn State's kind of in the same spot. Who have they played? You know, the one team that's kind of semi-good, Iowa, took them right to the wire. But they've flattened everybody else. I mean, they definitely look the part. You know, it's interesting. Saquon Barkley, I think one of the reasons he's up for the Heisman front-runner kind of status right now is because of his special teams. Because when you look at his rushing stats, he's not anywhere close to Josh Adams.
Going through Eric's AP top 5 for this week, team number 3.
I wrestled with 3 and 2, and I ended up going with Georgia at number 3. I still think Alabama's done more, and I think Alabama's offense is ahead of where Georgia's is. And that's simply because Jalen Hurts is a sophomore, and Jake from State Fromm is a freshman. But Jake is 12th in the country in passing efficiency.
Your team number 2 in the country.
Alabama, and so I am not contributing to the rat poison problem since I don't have Alabama number 1.
And number 1 is?
Going with Clemson. I think their defense is outstanding, but it'll be interesting to see how soon Kelly Bryant gets back from them at quarterback, because they're going to need him.
So Eric's AP top 5 for this week: Clemson 1, then Alabama, Georgia, Penn State, and the Washington Huskies, who always play deep into the night for viewers on the East Coast. It is now 5 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Budweiser's weekday sports beat on 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Here's Eric Hansen with what's coming up in tomorrow's South Bend Tribune Sports Section.
Well, if you want to know who the heck is Deion McIntosh, Notre Dame's fourth string running back who's their third leaning rusher, Mike Varell has all those answers for you in a story. It's a pretty cool story. Talk to his high school coach. He's got a very good younger brother that's a college prospect. We have high school volleyball sectionals today, Darren, and much, much more.
Look forward to that in tomorrow's South Bend Tribune Sports Section. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you.
He's Eric Hansen. I'm Darren Pritchett. Sean Steyers will join me in just a couple of moments for another hour of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT South Bend.
Your home for every Notre Dame football game.
Goodbye, Brandon Wimbush. 58 yards.
Sanders is pulling away with every stride, and he goes in. 92 yards.
Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT, presents.
Races on. Josh Adams wins it. Touchdown, Notre Dame. 98 yards. 76-yard touchdown play to Equanimeous St. Brown.
Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Faulkner breaks one tackle down the near sideline, gets a block, cuts back inside. Touchdown, Faulkner and Mishawaka.
York now in front, Ogletee. They score! They score! Notre Dame to the Frozen Four! Gets up and in by Rex Kluger with 1.5 seconds left. Notre Dame leads.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Steyers.
You know, we got to attack. We got to be on attack mode. There's no relaxing just because we're up in the series. I'm a big, big believer in travel day wins. You got to get that win on a travel day because it makes everything better. The flight's better. Everything. The morale's better. So tomorrow we have a chance to seal it up here at Wrigley Field, and I expect our fans to be insane just like they always are, and we'll be ready to go.
Anthony Rizzo, one of the heroes of Game 3 yesterday with that bloop RBI single into left field, helping the Cubs to turn back the Nationals 2-1. Cubs lead the NLDS 2-1. Game 4 is in a weather delay right now. And when you look at the radar, you wonder when they're going to get started. If they do get started tonight with Game 4, and it's very important, I would think, for the Cubs, they want to play tonight. No matter what, Joe Madden says Jake Arrieta is starting Game 4, whether it's today, tomorrow, or 3 weeks from now. Now, the Nationals, they have Tanner Roark going today, but if Game number 4 is tomorrow, then Steven Strasburg would be ready to pitch Game 4, which changes the complexion of Game number 4.
Big difference. Big difference.
And Jason Hayward might start then. Because he was not in the lineup today because he's 0-18 against Tanner Roark.
Yeah. I was going to say, Dusty Baker might still make some crazy decisions or indecisions.
National fans got to be upset with his decision in the seventh inning to bring in that left-hander. That just, it looks good on paper, but you had to have known that Albert Almora creams left-handed pitching, and that's the wild card for Madden sitting on the bench if you bring in the lefty. And Dusty Baker played right into Joe Madden's hands. And Almora got the hit to tie it up. Rizzo got the hit in the eighth inning to put them in front. Wade Davis did Wade Davis things in the ninth inning. And the Cubs won 2-1. That was tough to watch if you're a National fan, not to go with your best guy. Sometimes you don't always go with the matchup. Sometimes you go with the best guy.
Yep.
And they did not. And that's why many would say, do you want to go into the offseason knowing you left Steven Strasburg waiting for Game 5 and not using him today?
Well, and maybe Tito Francona would be the one to ask that question at the same time because he brought Trevor Bauer back. As great as Trevor Bauer was in Game 1 of that series, he brought him back on short rest last night, and he did not. He says he felt good, but he did not look good. The result was not good. And now, what's Kluber? Is Kluber still going to be? He's got to be at least on a day short rest as well, right?
I remember what Francona said when he made the decision to start Kluber in Game 2, that Kluber wanted to pitch on normal rest.
Mm-hmm.
So that would assume would be 4 days?
He was normal rest for Game 2, but for this one now, for Game 5, he's not going to be. Because this whole thing's only taken a week, so, yeah.
Which is, in comparison to the NBA playoffs first round, which goes 3 weeks.
Yeah.
How they drag that out. You play Tuesday, Sunday, Thursday. It just never seems to end. So, a weather delay at Wrigley Field. Cubs and Nationals will Game 4 be played tonight. Huge question mark. And we'll talk more about the playoffs coming up in just a little bit. We've got rapid fire on the way. We want to talk about Mitchell Trubisky. But first, a little Notre Dame appetizer for you. It's a bye week for the Irish. Their next game, October 21st, at home against 5-1 USC. They could be 6-1 if they take care of Utah at the Coliseum this Saturday. So, the Irish won their opener over Temple, lost the one-point game at home to Georgia. Now they've ripped off four consecutive victories, five blowout wins for this Fighting Irish football team. And Brian Kelly on Saturday was asked about how the Irish have gotten to 5-1. Is it the way that you expected?
I'm more pleased with the mental preparation, which was, you know, certainly an area that was of great focus, has really been the core of this football team and how they approach things, especially the second half. As you know, second half was not, you know, something that was handled very well last year, and they're handling it very well.
All right, so Brian wanted to talk about the mentality, the mental condition of this football team. So the Irish are 5-1. Sean, as you look at the way they've gotten to 5-1, is it the way that you expected?
Well, I'm not surprised that they are 5-1, but I am surprised with the way they got there. I would have to say that because, and this is coming into the season, we know about all the close losses last year, obviously, but only Nevada, Army, and USC were decided one way or another by more than 8 points. That's only 3 out of 12 games last year. So I didn't expect to see such a thoroughly dominating run game that they have right now, as well as an almost as dominant defense, and maybe just as dominant defense that they have. I felt like they could win these games, but I didn't think that they would be as lopsided as they've been. We knew that there would be some questions going into Georgia, but I just don't think that those other five games, the ones they've won, would be this lopsided. Maybe you'd think within a touchdown or two, especially a game like Michigan State, even Boston College, like we talked about, just the way Boston College games have gone over the years, I felt like there would be some closer games, but they were all winnable games.
BC was for a little while.
Yeah.
The third quarter.
Right. NC State, North Carolina was close at halftime, so.
And then a safety right before halftime.
Oof. And that's, I mean, you talk about dumb coaching decisions, too. That was just like they were saying on the broadcast. You kneel down a couple of times, go to the locker room, you're done. You don't have to worry about anything.
We'll get to dumb coaching decisions from the Bears game last night in a couple of moments. But how the Irish got to 5-1, is it how I expected? You know, I look at it this way. The run game and the offensive line was going to be very good. I got to change very good to exceptional so far. Outside of the Georgia game, they have been absolutely dominating. The passing game I thought was going to be above average. I would say it's below average at this time with still room to grow as this season goes on. I mean, nobody could have expected how inactive Equanimeous St. Brown has been in the passing game. Now, with the way you run the football and you don't complete as many passes, sure, everybody's numbers are going to be down, but, I mean, he's not going to get to 30 catches maybe. And you've asked a couple of rapid fires, and I continue to go over just thinking it's going to click. But
it keeps shrinking.
It's remarkable. I mean, would you have thought with the number of catches he has, they could be 5-1? I don't think so.
No, I know, and that's really when you look at the way things have happened. The fact that, as you said, the passing game is really below average. When you have a receiver that had a season like Equanimeous St. Brown had last year and who has the skills that he has, you expect that no matter who you have at quarterback, he's going to be putting up pretty respectable numbers. He's going to be a major threat game in and game out, but we just haven't seen it so far.
To put it into perspective, just passing yards, Notre Dame is 114th in the country. The worst passing offense national ranking by a Brian Kelly team since he arrived. was 71. And that was the 12 team that went to the title game, strangely enough. And in terms of pass efficiency, Notre Dame is 115th in the country. And the worst number during the Brian Kelly era, again, was 2012 with Everett Golson. They were 74.
Man.
So a huge difference between the 12 team and this year's team. And just for the sake of argument, DeShone Kizer was the main guy in 15 and throughout 16. Pass efficiency offense, 2015, Notre Dame was 23rd in the country. Last year, 36. Right now, number 115. Now, in terms of defense, I'm blown away. Absolutely blown away. Couldn't have dreamed Mike Elko and this coaching staff could have made this defense as competitive and as good as it's been. I remember during the offseason, that's what I would always say. I just want the defense to be competitive. They went beyond that.
Yeah.
They're 15th in the country in scoring defense. They've matched the turnover total created from last year with 14. They're outscoring. Now, this is the offense, of course, factoring into this. But 73-10 points off turnovers so far this year. The defense helping the offense. And even though they've been on the field for a lot of plays, they'll bend a little bit in the middle of the field, but down in the red zone, they've been awfully good. They've created turnovers. The pass rush is getting better. So how they got to 5-1, I am a little blown away how far along this defense is, because we talked about the horror stories of the safety position and the backup defensive lineman. Things have worked out. Now, challenges ahead, I mean, all over the place. You look at total offense and the teams coming up on the schedule. This is just total offense. USC 30th, NC State 25, Wake Forest 72, Miami 27, Navy 12, Stanford 42. Landmines all over the place. Doesn't diminish what this offense and this defense has done so far this year. Pretty incredible.
Yeah, and really, when you think about it, what the defense has done, now they've gone about it in a different way, but what you're talking about with the bend but don't break and that kind of thing, a lot of that applies to that 2012 team as well. Now, they were really stout against the run and all that kind of stuff, but they would give up some yards. But once teams got down inside the red zone, just like what you were saying, that's where they really stiffened as well. They didn't give up a whole lot of points once teams got down there in the red zone. They got real stout.
They did, yeah. Brian Kelly, again, after the game on Saturday in Chapel Hill, he was asked if he saw 5-1 coming after losing at home to Georgia 20-19.
I knew that we were in a different place with our football team in terms of their total preparation in all areas. You can never predict how a game is going to unfold. Things can happen. Been in this long enough to know. But I was confident in the football team and its preparation, and we really had a great shot to win the games that we played. I wasn't forecasting anything other than the next week. I felt good about my football team.
So try to go back to the Georgia game. What you were thinking, did you think 5-1 was possible?
I guess I wasn't thinking about that big picture, but I definitely felt standing there watching that game that even though it was a one-point loss, it was a close loss, all that stuff, that it definitely felt different just seeing the team that I saw on the field. I know a lot of people were ready to jump off the ledge because Brandon Wimbush had his problems. The offensive line obviously had its problems and all that different stuff. But I definitely felt like that was the best defense that they had seen, that they wouldn't see a better defense at least until the month of November. Nothing that has happened has changed my mind about that, and I still think that Georgia is the best team they've played so far. They're probably gonna win out until they get to the SEC championship game, and at least to this point in the season, USC will be the second best team that they've faced, so now they'll have another opportunity to really show how far they've come since then and show what they can do against a team that's not great in USC, but it is pretty good still. It's just a one-loss team.
I remember talking about 5-1 is very possible, but I got to admit, after the Georgia game, I was just concerned about the pass protection scheme in that game where there just didn't seem to be the corrections to what Georgia was doing. There was just a couple of those occasions where there were three defenders on one Notre Dame pass blocker, and you're not going to win that battle if you're the Fighting Irish. So that was concerning, but you felt like it was a veteran offensive line that they could get that squared away. And I will say this. At halftime of the BC game, I had just a slight bit of doubt in my mind only because the way BC ran the football in the first half against the Irish. That was not a good running BC team. There was over-pursuing. There was missed tackles in the first half. So I remember thinking at halftime, I was a little concerned about the inability to stop the run in that first half, and could we be heading down another road of not being able to stop the run? But now you look at where they are right now. There was absolutely nothing to be worried about. The defense has held its own. I mean, Georgia didn't run over the Irish. They ran over everybody else. Notre Dame held their own against that Georgia run game. So even though there were a couple of things that were concerning, you just looked at the schedule. You thought there was a chance to go into USC at 5-1, and here they are. But as we just talked about, they sure didn't get there in the way that we had thought at the start of the year.
I'll agree about BC, the first half of BC. That was watching, other than the Georgia game, that was the most probably one of the more frustrating halves to watch, because you started to see, as you said, some of those breakdowns defensively that even against Georgia we really didn't see, and we definitely didn't see them against Temple. Yeah. So you're going, okay, where is this team? And I think it goes back to what you were talking about. They were just a little over-aggressive. There was too much over-pursuit. But again, like we've talked about, the halftime adjustments, you didn't see those breakdowns in the second half. And the adjustments that Mike Elko and his staff and the team have been able to make at the halftime of games have just been unparalleled. They've just been great. They have shut teams down, by and large, in the second half this year.
Irish will do some practicing tomorrow. Brandon Wimbush is expected to be cleared and take the first team reps at quarterback after missing the North Carolina game with the foot. So good news there with Brandon Wimbush. Let's shift gears on SportsBeat to the National Football League. Sean Steyers, Darren Pritchett with you. Monday Night Football last night at Soldier Field. Bears fans a little more excited than normal to watch their team play, because North Carolina rookie quarterback Mitchell Trubisky got his first career start on the opening drive. The way he was slinging that football, I thought a lot of fans were about ready to jump out of their seats, run on the field, and give him a hug like the Western Michigan sister did to her brother in a game last week against Buffalo. He came out and looked very good, but my goodness, can a team be any worse at self-destructing around the rookie quarterback? Penalties, missed assignments, dropped passes. I felt sorry for him. He was actually playing pretty well in the first quarter, and every time you looked up, it seemed like it was second and 19 because somebody did something bonehead from the other 10 positions on this offense. Now, the final numbers, he was 12 of 25 for 128, a touchdown and an interception. I actually thought he was a little better than that. Now, he made mistakes, and we'll get to that coming up in a second, that cost his team. But I was really impressed with the way they got him out of the pocket, and he threw on the run. I actually thought back to something I talked about years ago as a Bronco fan, knowing John Fox and Adam Gase, who was the offensive coordinator in Denver, who went to Chicago and worked with Jay Cutler. Cutler worked in that system because he was good getting out of the pocket. And I always said, as a Bronco fan, I think he should have hired Adam Gase instead of John Fox. Now, the offense in Miami is struggling right now with Gase in charge of it. But I was a big Adam Gase fan. If Gase was the head coach of the Bears, that's what he loves to do with his quarterbacks, get them out of the pocket. Mitchell Trubisky would be a perfect fit into Adam Gase's offense. I think he's interesting. I just don't know if they have the personnel to build around him. I don't know if I trust their management to be able to build around him, to be perfectly honest.
It's interesting because I was listening to the Dan Patrick show earlier today, and he had Michael Wilbon on from ESPN, and he's a Chicago native and renowned Chicago sports fan. He loves all the Chicago teams, and he said he was talking to some NFL guys, and they essentially – they told him that the Bears had no idea what they were doing on draft night. There was not a big demand for Mitch Trubisky. And I think Mitch Trubisky can be a good NFL quarterback, but they could have had Deshaun Watson, obviously, if they wanted him. The trade that they made, giving up the draft pick, there was no demand for them
for other teams being highly, you know, going after Mitch Trubisky. So just to what you're talking about whether or not you should have confidence in the fact that they're going to build something around him, I think you really have to have some questions about that, especially considering what they did in the next couple rounds after that night.
Well, the game was 17-17, late fourth quarter. The Bears deep in their own territory. Trubisky rolled to his right, threw for his tight end, Miller, and stepping in front, former Notre Dame safety Harrison Smith. He came up with the interception, and ultimately the Vikings would kick a field goal, and that would be the difference. 20-17, Vikings over the Bears after the game. Trubisky talked about that costly interception.
Basically, me trying to do too much, trying to make a play when I just need to know the situation, throw the ball away, and play another down. But I got a lot of faith in my receivers out there, and Zach, and I was just trying to do too much outside of what I need to do. Just know the situation, know it's first down, throw that ball away, and go play. So I just forced one. Thought I gave him a chance, and the other dude made a play, so credit to him. But I can't do that. Can't put my team in that situation.
Also, Trubisky was asked about how the media felt like the players surrounding Trubisky were a little extra motivated knowing that this rookie was going out on the field to get his first career start.
I was trying to. Just with my presence, how much I love this game and how much I love this team, and hopefully that could just motivate some guys to play harder and I think they have faith in me. They believe me when I'm in that huddle and when I'm making plays and when things break down. They know the plays is never really over. Anything could happen. And so hopefully the way I work and the way I carry myself just lifts others up, because that's what I'm trying to do. And it just makes playing with these guys so much better, and it makes the whole process that much more fun.
Well, at North Carolina, he was in the shotgun. And I just can't stop thinking about the first day in Bears practice. He was under center and couldn't take the snap. So he's come a long way.
That's right.
In that area. There's reason to be optimistic if you're a Bears fan. It's just, can you keep the parts around him healthy? Can they add on to those parts? Now, John Fox, the head coach of the Bears, was asked to talk about Trubisky's first start. And here is what the Bears head man had to say.
I mean, he's got what it takes. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. You know, and like I said, it was for our first game. You know, I go back to, you know, watching guys like, you know, Montana in their first game. You know, so it's I've seen a few of them. I'm not making comparisons at this point, but he's going to do nothing but get better.
I'd probably avoid any Joe Montana comparisons.
Yeah.
At this particular
That'd
moment.
That'd be a good idea.
That would be okay. What the heck was John Fox doing in the first quarter? They had fourth down and two and plus territory. They have the offense on the field. They take a timeout. They bring the punting team on the field during the timeout. Toward the end of the timeout, Trubisky and the offense runs back out there. The play clock's at five.
Mm-hmm.
And they take a delay of game penalty. And they go from fourth and two to fourth and seven. John. You're not a rookie head coach.
You got to be, yeah, he's
what
been around.
What the heck?
You got to be ready to go.
I was totally in favor of the Bears going for it in that spot. It was a scoreless game. You're a one-win football team. They were moving the ball. I thought it was a great time to go for the first down, and they talked themselves out of it, then re-talked themselves into it, but the play clock ran out, and they got a delay of game. That is absolutely unacceptable. Rookie coach, 15th year head coach, that cannot happen. That is a head coach putting his football team in not the best position to succeed. That is all on the head coach for being indecisive.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to know. Are you going for it or not? You're already changing quarterbacks here in game five. It's not like you're going to be playing for a playoff spot by the end of the season. It's you're either going to go for it or you're not, and you've got to have your call sheet ready to go. It's just like your two-point conversion. If you're going to go for it on fourth and two, you've got to know what your plays are going to be. You're going to have a short list of plays, just like for a two-point conversion, you're going to have a short list of plays because you're talking about a couple yards there. You've got to know right away, and you're either going to do it or not. You can't be doing what they did because, as you said, yeah, you put your team at a huge disadvantage, and for a veteran head coach, it's inexcusable.
Peyton Manning carried him to a Super Bowl as a head coach. And then the Seattle Seahawks John Fox out on a stretcher that game after the Seahawks demolished Denver in Super Bowl 48. And John Elway was not a fan of John Fox's head coaching style. He got rid of him. And it was a bold move and went with Gary Kubiak and now Vance Joseph. Well, they won a Super Bowl since. Honestly, they don't win that Super Bowl if John Fox is the head coach.
No, you're right about that.
Unimpressed with him as a head coach. And I was stunned the Bears went down that road. I can't imagine he'll be back next year. I know the personnel is not there, but there just needs to be a different direction for this football team. They just seem like they're just stuck in mud right now. Maybe Trubisky can help out, but that particular moment, that sequence does not help in trying to bring John Fox back as a head coach. That type of coaching can't happen.
Well, I mean, look at the Rams right now, the Los Angeles Rams. They had a coach and Jeff Fisher, who was around for a long time. And,
Mr. 8 and 8.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. 8 and 8. And they hire this guy, Sean McVay, who really nobody had ever heard of. And now, are they going to be a contender at the end of the year? I don't know. But they went with a coach that's better suited for a young quarterback, offensive mind, young and full of energy and the whole thing. And really, when you look at the Bears situation, that's kind of the direction that I think they need to go next year.
I'm with you on that. And speaking of Jay Cutler, remember what I talked about? Maybe they should stick with Matt Moore. His numbers weren't too bad last year at the end of the year, his quarterback rating. Dolphins can't score any points right now.
Nope.
The fans were chanting for Matt Moore down in Miami.
Man.
I mean, like I said, he's not going to be any different. He is who he is. It's not going to change. I mean, you want a quarterback who rode off into the sunset and took a picture of him butt naked on the beach? I mean, come on. Is that what you want as your quarterback?
Well, you know, and I saw a quote from him. He was asked, I think it was after he had gone back to the NFL, about what kind of preparation he was doing for when he was going to be on TV, and he was essentially winging it. I mean, this is, it shows he's got to be the least prepared veteran NFL quarterback there is.
No one has stolen more money from the NFL than Jay Cutler.
Not going to change.
He got $10 million from the Dolphins.
Yeah,
and same old Jay.
I'd take it.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, rapid fire coming up next here on 96.1 FM WSBT.
Hi, this is Dan Patrick, and you're listening to South Bend's number one sports talk show, Weekday Sports Beat on 96.1 WSBT.
You can catch the Dan Patrick Show tomorrow morning, every weekday morning, 9 to noon on Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM WSBT. Well, we're going to do a little double switch. We're going to go baseball now, then rapid fire next segment, because the Cubs-Nationals game has been rained out. Major League Baseball has made the decision to call tonight's game. No pitches were thrown. And game four of the National League Divisional Series between the Cubs and the Nationals will be tomorrow at 4:08. So 4:08 South Bend time. First pitch for the Cubs and the Nationals at Wrigley Field tomorrow, with the Cubs leading the best of five series 2-1. And according to AccuWeather, there was a 50 to 70% chance of rain throughout this evening. So not a good situation for baseball in Chicago. Now, Dusty Baker is on the record as saying, well, I don't know if I'm going to start Tanner Roark or Steven Strasburg if there's a rain out. Dusty, can we have a little talk? Dusty, you do not want to go into the offseason knowing you did not use Steven Strasburg in game four. He's going to be on 4 days rest on Wednesday. If he chooses Tanner Roark, I wish him the best of luck.
Absolutely. There's just a little bit of difference between those two. That's exactly it. No-brainer is right. But as you said at the top of the show, Joe Maddon has already said that it's Jake Arrieta. No matter what, do you like that decision? Sticking with Arrieta over Hendricks, who shut out the Nationals in game one when Strasburg pitched.
I'm always a believer when you have a chance to win the series, you try to win the series. You try to close it out.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way I look at it. Kyle Hendricks is the best pitcher in their rotation as of right now. Jake Arrieta could be dominant in game four. The numbers say in September in three starts with the hamstring, his ERA is over six. July and August, he was sub two. He was one of the best pitchers in baseball those 2 months, but his last three starts in September were very poor with the six ERA. I feel like Arrieta, my gut is, he would be perfectly fine in game four. But Kyle Hendricks has been lights out in his career in the postseason, was great in game one. It would be awfully hard not to go with Kyle. I think the decision is much more difficult for Joe. I don't think he can go wrong either way. I've got a hunch that Arrieta would be okay. Then you got Kyle for game five. So even though I started the conversation by saying when you have a chance to close out a team, you put your best foot forward.
You've tucked yourself back around. Right?
Arrieta has been awfully good in the postseason in the past, so I think I would go with Jake, and that's a pretty good guy to have in your back pocket pitching on the road in Game 5 or Game 1 of the NLCS and Kyle Hendricks.
I'm not a fan of the short rest scenario unless you are the team backed into the corner and your options are a lot more limited. If you're facing elimination and it's a short rest situation, then yes, I would do that. But I'm not. If you're up, which the Cubs are, or even, and it's not an elimination situation, I always hedge toward, I don't like the short rest situation. So I would avoid that if I could.
I guess if you don't pitch Arrieta in game four, when do you pitch him if you continue on?
Yeah.
It's going to be a long layoff if he doesn't pitch. If you get to the National League Championship Series, I can't imagine they'd use him in game one.
Because if you don't, then you would still, if you're going to go with Hendricks tomorrow or whenever it happens to be, if you're going to go with Hendricks, then you'd still rather have Lester than Arrieta.
That's what I was thinking.
So, yeah.
That's like, when do you pitch Arrieta then? I guess he maybe would be game one of the National League Championship Series. But is Russ going to be a factor? There's just a lot of moving parts. I know you got to worry about game four. That's all Joe Maddon can worry about at this time, but it is kind of a domino effect how the pieces fit if you move up Hendricks for game number four.
Mm-hmm.
He's your best guy. I know he doesn't throw 98. He's not Corey Kluber, but you know what? His numbers are Corey Kluber-esque in terms of ERA. He's just awfully hard to pass up in game four, but I'm going to stick with Arrieta. I think Jake, I'd go with my hunch that he would be able to do the job in game four.
They have to have numbers for all these guys as mm-hmm. well about short rest and long rest and the whole thing. And with all those numbers at their disposal, it gives them the ability to make at least a lot more informed decision than just winging it and going yeah. with their gut, even though Dusty Baker probably throws that stuff out the window. So. Which will hit in rapid fire coming up next. I've been kind of giving Dusty some shots.
Please don't ever have a rapid fire question. Which would you rather, Dusty Baker or Mike Matheny? I might implode. Right. I might just run out of the room and say neither.
I was waiting to see who that or was going to be.
Oh, you know who the or is in my world.
It won't be Matheny. I'll put it that way.
Oh, God. All right, so Cubs and Nationals, 4:08 first pitch, Wrigley Field tomorrow. Tonight's game is postponed. Rapid fire next on WSBT.
We called the game, rescheduled tomorrow for 4:08 Eastern time. You know, it's the Windy City, so things, you know, get blown around. But the one thing that was constant is that it was going to rain for a good portion of the night.
That's Major League Baseball's Chief Baseball Officer Joe Torre making the announcement. Cubs and Nationals postpone 4:08 first pitch tomorrow. And we are hearing that it will be Tanner Roark starting for the Nationals. And allegedly, Steven Strasburg, who could go on 4 days rest, is under the weather. Break for the Chicago Cubs.
Yeah, no kidding, if that's true.
Baseball gods gave the Nationals a gift by having this game postponed, and the Nationals are going to give it right back to the Cubs.
That's right.
Maybe Roark throws a one-hitter, but I'm not expecting that tomorrow. So, apparently, no Strasburg. That's a huge, huge bonus for the Chicago Cubs. We've got 5 minutes worth of rapid fire to get to here on WSBT.
All right, we'll get some baseball in a minute. I'm going to start with a Notre Dame question, though. Buy or sell Paul Feinbaum, the Paul Feinbaum, saying Notre Dame is in position to make a college football playoff appearance.
I heard him talk about this, that he's saying that with everything in front of Notre Dame, they have an opportunity to make the playoff.
Yeah.
And with all the great opponents they have coming up, absolutely. Can't disagree with him. Way to go, Paul.
Yeah. It's the first and maybe only time you'll ever hear you say that. But yeah,
it's not going to be easy, though.
He's not saying they're going to. He's saying that they're in position with what's in front of them, the tough schedule they've got. That if they run the table, that they should be in. Yeah, we've kind of talked about it as well. They've got a quality loss to Georgia, and as long as Georgia takes care of their business, if Notre Dame does it, I mean, yeah. And I mean, when you look at that loss to Georgia, the one-point loss, it's, you know, their closest game since that win is a 27-point win over Vanderbilt. They have just destroyed everybody since then. So, yep.
I
buy it as well. Okay, over under 950 passing yards for Brandon Wimbush over the last six games of the season. He has 782 in five games right now. So I'm saying 950 in six games for Wimbush.
So that's the over under?
Yeah.
I'm going to go over because the Irish will be playing from behind more so in the second half than in the first half.
Okay.
Not saying they're going to lose all those games. I'm just saying it's going to be a more difficult half. So, and you're going to need to throw the ball better against some of these teams.
Yeah, I agree, too. They're going to have to be a lot more balanced against some of these teams. There are a couple teams like Navy, for example, even though they've got a good record and we know what their offense is from a Notre Dame offensive standpoint, they should be able to pound away against them. They shouldn't have to throw as much. But USC, NC State, a lot of these games, they're going to have to pass more. All he has to do really is average about 158 a game to get to 950. So I'm going to go over as well.
And Strasburg could pitch game five if there is a game five.
All right.
Reading those accounts.
All right. To the managerial decisions. Here's the toss-up for you. Which manager has the bigger blunder so far this postseason? Yankees Joe Girardi for his non-replay challenge against Cleveland last Friday, or Dusty Baker for basically anything he did from the seventh inning on in yesterday's loss to the Cubs?
Great argument for both. I will break the tie by saying Joe Girardi is a well-respected manager. He says he didn't challenge because he didn't want to break the rhythm of his pitcher. It's a tough argument. Tough argument. When you have a chance to change the complexion of an inning, you have to go for it. But as the seventh inning unfolded, I didn't understand the direction Dusty was going and not going with his best pitchers. Knowing Almora hits lefties hard, why would you bring in a lefty with a 580 ERA to face Almora? And he burned him. So I'm going to go with Dusty Baker. Mainly because, hey, both guys made a mistake, but Dusty has more of a track record of making those mistakes, so that breaks the tie.
Okay, I can see that line of thinking. I mean, Dusty's moves, they were questionable. He pulls Max Scherzer after just 98 pitches, doesn't go to Ryan Madsen, doesn't go to Sean Doolittle. They acquired those guys at the deadline for the purpose of really bolstering their only weakness. Yeah. Their bullpen was their only weakness. They've got the starting pitching.
Yeah.
And then he does it. Then with first base open, he pitches to Anthony Rizzo with a right-hander. So Dusty's was definitely a series of moves. And maybe it's because of the track record that I have to lean towards Girardi, because it was such an easy decision to make. His catcher, Sanchez, turns and says, challenge that. Because essentially the question was, did the pitch from Chad Green, did it hit the barrel or the knob of the bat, or did it hit the guy? And it was Lonnie Chisenhall. Did it hit Chisenhall or did it hit his bat? And the replay showed that it hit his bat and not Chisenhall. So instead, loads the bases, grand slam. I mean, if Girardi makes that challenge, the series could be over right now. Yeah. The Yankees might have won that series. So that's, I've got to go with that one.
With the managerial expertise, I'm shocked the Nationals and Cardinals don't play to scoreless ties. Leave it at that.
All right.
All right. Save the rest of your rapid fire for tomorrow. 5 minutes in front of the top of the hour on WSBT. Budweiser's weekday sports beat presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some buns. Even though there are a lot of things aren't happening this week with Notre Dame on a bye, Leprechaun Lunch will happen.
It will happen. That's right. We are here 52 weeks a year.
All right. Very good. Irish hockey coach Jeff Jackson joins us tomorrow night at 6:30 to talk about number 4 Notre Dame hosting number 1 Denver this weekend. Hope you'll join us then.
The home of Notre Dame football, the NFL, weekday sports beat, and JT in the morning, 960 AM, 96.1 FM, WSBT, South Bend.